Welcome to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. As we say goodbye to 2013, we thought we'd get a jump on 2014 by discussing the biggest conservation issues here in the Gila region and teeing things up for you all for the new year. Some of the most controversial natural resource use decisions on the table right now will be decided in 2014. New Mexico will choose whether or not it will divert the Gila River. The Forest Service will release its travel management plan for the Gila National Forest, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will finalize changes to the rules governing Mexican gray wolf reintroduction. Joining me today to discuss these issues and more are my two Earth Matters co-producers, Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and Nathan Newcomer, Gila Grassroots Organizer with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Good morning, Donna and Nathan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Let's start out, Nathan, with Mexican gray wolf issues. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to delist the gray wolf as an endangered species, and this will have huge implications for the Mexican gray wolf, which is a subspecies of the gray wolf. There's also a proposed rule to make changes to the Mexican gray wolf reintroduction program that will impact the genetic health and legal protections of this endangered species. And Nathan, can you help us kind of decipher and figure out these different rulemakings?
Sure, be happy to. Let's start off with sort of the good news, if you will, because I always like to get into that first. The good news is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to change two important things that would impact the Mexican gray wolf. The first one is to expand the boundary of the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area, which currently is the national forest boundaries of the Gila and the Apache Sitgraves in Arizona. What they're proposing to expand it to would be to go all the way north to I-40 in both states and all the way south to I-10 in both states. And then the east and west, it would go all the way to the borders of Arizona and New Mexico. So it'd be a very large increase in the actual boundary for the Mexican gray wolf. Right now, we know that wolves are already leaving the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area and going outside the boundary, and they're constantly having to be taken back in. So that's a nuisance. So that's a really good step. It's not the best step. The best step would be to have the boundary expanded to include all of New Mexico, all of Arizona, as well as all of Utah and Colorado. That's sort of like the dream, is to get those four Rocky Mountain states to be eligible to have Mexican gray wolves roam around. The other thing that they're proposing to do is to release wolves directly into New Mexico, because currently that has never happened. Wolves are only released in Arizona, and then they just make their way over into New Mexico naturally. That's definitely a bit of a problem in the past with trying to establish actual viable populations. So those are the two good things I would say that are coming out of these proposed rule changes. The really bad thing, though, as you alluded to in the opening, was that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to delist the gray wolf, which is the proper species of the wolf. The Mexican gray wolf is the subspecies of the gray wolf. And there are lots of gray wolves in the United States. They're all over the Rocky Mountain West. They're all over Montana, Minnesota, up in the Great Lakes region. There's hundreds and thousands of them. So I can understand why there is sort of a push to do that. But what it does is it would target the Mexican gray wolf, because it is a subspecies of the gray wolf, and it would take it off of the endangered species list, which would be a catastrophe. So we don't like that. And there's been a lot of work going in to make sure that that doesn't happen. I can report that there is now a letter with 80 representatives in Congress that have signed on to not delisting the gray wolf. So there is progress being made, not just, you know, locally, but also at the national level. So we're happy to see that moving forward. The deadline for comments to submit on the rule changes is tomorrow.
December 17th.
Yeah, yeah. Is tomorrow, December 17th. So if folks haven't yet gotten their comments in, you still have one more day to do it. So I definitely encourage people to do that. And the best place to get information on this effort is from the Lobos of the Southwest website, which is MexicanWolves.org. Again, that's MexicanWolves.org.
Yeah, that is a great one-stop shop for information. So, wow. So, Nathan, if the gray wolf is delisted, what does that mean for Mexican gray wolf reintroduction? Does that just basically nullify the reintroduction program? How does it work?
It wouldn't nullify it. It would definitely be a weird conflict of interest because you have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actively trying to change their management of the Mexican gray wolf program. But then you also have this effort to delist the gray wolf. So it would be in complete conflict with one another. It would be a catastrophe, really, because then the Mexican gray wolf would no longer have endangered species protections. And so people could start shooting them legally. Mm. I mean, people shoot Mexican wolves now illegally. They're not prosecuted for it. But if they were not protected under the Endangered Species Act, then it would just be free for all.
Right. So, wow, that sounds really terrible. So when do you expect in 2014 a decision to be made on the delisting rule?
Yeah, that's a really great question. If I had to look into my crystal ball, I would probably say somewhere around October.
October, yeah. Okay. And one other kind of related issue, and you've already done an Earth Matters show on this McKittrick policy, but tell us a bit about the McKittrick policy, because that really has implications for the Mexican gray wolf here in the Gila region.
It certainly does. And the strange thing about it is that nobody even knew this thing was out there. The McKittrick policy is a Department of Justice internal memo that was circulated back in 1998, around the exact same time that the Mexican gray wolf program began, was in 1998. So it's kind of ironic to see the timing. I don't think they're related, but it's just ironic. And what the McKittrick policy is, it's named after a guy in Montana named Chad McKittrick, who illegally killed a grizzly bear, which is protected under the Endangered Species Act. And he said his defense was, "Oh, I thought it was a black bear." And so at the time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said, "We don't care. You killed an endangered species. You should have known what you were shooting at, and you didn't. So we're going to prosecute you." And so they did prosecute him. He was found guilty, but he appealed his decision. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And before the Supreme Court even got a chance to hear it, for some reason, the Department of Justice stepped in and said, "Don't prosecute this individual." And they made this internal policy called the McKittrick policy that said, if you shoot an endangered species and you didn't know what it was, then we're not going to prosecute you. And so this is now known information amongst people that don't like Mexican gray wolves, people that are big private property advocates and don't like public lands and things of that nature. They know this. And so anytime, and it's not just here in New Mexico, it's all over the West. I mean, there was a case in Texas where a guy shot a whooping crane, there was like 30 whooping cranes in this one area. It was really a small population of them. He said, "Well, I thought it was a sandhill crane." He didn't get prosecuted. So the McKittrick policy is really, really bad. And what we have done is we have decided to sue the Department of Justice. And so we filed litigation against DOJ earlier this year. And we expect to have a hearing come up early next year to actually see this thing through. Because we just can't have this thing on the books anymore. It's detrimental. Mexican wolves are being shot and killed in New Mexico and Arizona, and people are using this policy to get off the hook.
So is it New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, just you guys, or have you joined forces with other groups?
The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, our staff attorney, Judy Kalman, has partnered with a pro bono attorney that works with the Wild Earth Guardians.
Okay.
He's an individual that knows what he's doing. He actually worked on the Otero Mesa litigation with the state of New Mexico back in the early 2000s, which we won, and that nullified the oil and gas leasing program for Otero Mesa. So he's a very smart individual. We feel really confident about this. It may not have to go all the way through the legal system. DOJ may just say, "Okay, we'll just get rid of it," which would be great. But we're definitely going to see this thing through.
Has the McKittrick policy been used here in New Mexico or Arizona?
It certainly has.
Specifically for the Mexican gray wolf?
It certainly has.
Okay.
People have said,
we have had shootings of
people
wolves.
Said, "Oh, I thought it was a coyote."
Right.
Or, "I thought it was a dog," or whatever. You know, they can say that and they will not be prosecuted. And the McKittrick policy seems to really come up in really the controversial issues. Like grizzly bears or wolves. Like those are really hot button issues in small town communities. And so it's really cited a lot, you'll see often, in the really controversial areas.
Okay. And what other, some of the changes to the wolf reintroduction, Mexican gray wolf reintroduction programs, what are some of the other issues associated with that that you can talk about? I mean, I know it seems like there's a lot of pretty detrimental aspects to the wolf reintroduction program that really will impact the genetic health of the species. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Well, one of the really big issues is the U.S. Forest Service has, as we know, the Mexican gray wolf population is designated as a non-essential experimental population, which is one way of saying that they think it's important to protect the wolves, but at the same time not, because they're not essential enough to warrant that essential population designation. So we want to see that changed. And that's one thing that the Forest Service didn't, in the proposed rule changes, say they were going to change that. But there are a lot of people who were putting in their comments saying, you have to change that. You have to make the Mexican gray wolf species an essential population. Because if they're non-essential experimental, what are you doing?
Right.
I mean, where's the end goal here?
Right.
What are you hoping to actually get out of this? If we really want to bring the Mexican gray wolf species back, you have to make them essential. And so that's, I would say, one of the bigger challenges that we've been facing here in the Gila and with the wolves is because of that designation. So with only 75 wolves in the wild, we really need to see that changed. And so we hope, you know, fingers crossed, we'll hope to see it next year comes and what it brings.
Right. So just a recap, we have comments due tomorrow, December 17th. You can go to the website at
MexicanWolves.org.
MexicanWolves.org. You can comment directly from that website, and it's a terrific website to stay on top of meetings, important rulemakings that will impact the Mexican gray wolf, and you can do your part to participate in getting your comments heard. So we'll be right back after this short break and continue our discussion with Nathan Newcomer and Donna Stevens about the biggest conservation issues upcoming in 2014. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, and my guests today are my Earth Matters co-producers, Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. And we're going to shift gears and start talking about the travel management and land use plan revisions on the Gila National Forest. And Donna, we're hearing that the Forest Service will finally release the travel management plan for the Gila National Forest after 8 years in the making. So can you give us a quick synopsis of where we're at on the travel management plan?
Yeah, I just wanted to say first that the travel management plan is a process whereby all the national forests and grasslands in the country have to designate a road system that provides ample access for recreation and other forest uses, and that also protects the natural resources. So the Gila has been working on this since 2005. And when the rule originally came out, it was supposed to be finished in 2009. So we're only about 4 years behind right now, and the decision keeps getting delayed. So in January of 2011, the Gila National Forest released their draft environmental impact statement. And at that time, that document included many alternatives for how many roads there could be in the Gila. So depending on how you count the road miles, there, if you count user-created roads, it's where somebody drove their ATV or their four-wheel drive Jeep or truck once, and then other people drove over it again, it actually became a road at a certain point. So depending on if you count those user-created roads or not, there's more than 7,000 miles of roads in the Gila National Forest. So the draft environmental impact statement reduced the road mileages by different percentages, and the Forest Service's own preferred alternative reduced the road miles down to just over 3,300 miles of roads. And 3,300 miles of roads, that's enough to drive from San Diego to Maine. So we're talking a lot of roads and a pretty long distance here. And so right now we're waiting for the final environmental impact statement for the Forest Service's record of decision. And it was originally supposed to come out in 2011, then 2012, then 2013. And the latest that we've heard is that it should come out in about February or March of 2014. So we're really hoping that there aren't any more delays and we will see it at that time.
So are you expecting the preferred alternative basically to be the final record of decision? Or what do you think the final decision is going to be? Do we have any sense of that? Or
well, we haven't seen anything yet, so it's a little hard to say, but we assume that it will be that their final decision will look pretty much like their preferred alternative looked, and perhaps with some changes based on the public comments they received. Their preferred alternative was decent, and so we're hoping that it will look pretty close to that. Like one of the kind of hot-button issues was driving in the San Francisco River. So originally, years back when the Forest Service had released kind of a rollout plan, they originally designated a road right in the San Francisco River. But it seems like they finally saw the light, and for the draft environmental impact statement, there will be no road in the San Francisco River. So there's been some pushback on that, but we really hope that they'll stay strong on that issue and not cave in to pressure from off-road vehicle groups.
And why is it a bad idea to ride through a riparian area? I mean, why should we care about closing the San Francisco River to vehicle use?
Well, riparian areas are the most productive areas on the landscape, and they're less than 2% of the land. But that's where our critters have to go to get water and for food. And it's a more productive ecosystem, and so they're really important way beyond their small footprint. And so driving in rivers and streams is a pretty poor idea for several reasons. First is that these vehicles compact the riverbed, and so there's these spaces in between the gravel and the boulders that are habitat for fish and even farther down on the food chain for macroinvertebrates. So if there's no aquatic habitat for our fish, and let's face it, our native fish populations are in big trouble already, then we're making our fish more endangered by driving in the rivers.
And also, does driving in rivers and riparian areas, is it destroying stream banks and riparian vegetation too? I mean, have you seen some of that?
Yeah, because they often don't even stick to one route. They'll just kind of drive wherever they can. And so they're definitely crushing riparian vegetation and outright killing it. And then you mentioned the stream bank erosion, which is a pretty big deal too, because then all that excess sediment goes into the streams and again destroys the aquatic habitat.
Right. Right. So are there other areas or other roads as part of the travel management plan that will be closed to vehicle use that were also apart from the San Francisco River that are also important areas or things that you think kind of came up in the public comment period that were controversial or of huge concern to the public?
Well, in particular, there's one road that crosses the Gila River on the way to Turkey Creek. And so the Forest Service has said that they will close that road because right now that road crosses the Gila River many times. And so we hope that, again, that they stick to that and don't cave into pressure and that road will be closed. And then there's also the issue of road density in general across the entire forest. So there's kind of a rule of thumb that we really should have no more than one linear mile of road for every square mile of forest. And in many places in the forest, especially in areas that have been logged a long time ago, it's just like a spaghetti bowl of roads out there. There's just so many roads, and really high road density It's really bad for habitat fragmentation. And so although to us we look at a road and it doesn't look like much of an obstacle, many species of wildlife are really reluctant to cross roads. And so it has pretty serious impacts on their habitat.
So is this the final word when there's a record of decision in February or March with the final environmental impact statement? Is that it? That's the final word, and then it just moves to implementation? Is that correct?
Well, there's actually time for appeals. So there might be a 30 or a 45-day appeal time when anybody who has already put in comments during the earlier phases could appeal the decision.
Okay. And then what does implementation look like? What happens next after the appeals play out and we've got a final travel management plan? What happens?
So the Forest Service will be issuing what they call a Motor Vehicle Use Map, or MVUM for short. And this is supposed to be the enforcement tool. So there'll be free maps that people could pick up at any of the Forest Service offices. And anybody who's out there on their ATV or their four-wheel drive or any vehicle, really, if they're on a road that is not on that motor vehicle use map, then they're in violation of the rule. And so the Forest Service has said that this map is the enforcement tool and that they will give warnings or citations to people who are on roads that are officially closed. And another big thing about travel management planning is that when it's implemented finally, that the forest will be closed to cross-country travel, in other words, driving wherever you want to off-road. So that in itself is a pretty big deal and a really important change to protect the forest.
Okay.
And if I could just add a more thing to that, as far as the implementation goes, after the Forest Service issues that motor vehicle use map, they will then have to address the issue of decommissioning. Because now that they have all these roads that are sitting out there that are closed to public access, they actually have to obliterate those roads. They have to do that by 2015.
And when you say obliterate, what does that really mean? I mean, is it revegetating roads or
it can be.
Or reclaiming
it
roads?
It can be. And the reason why they didn't do decommissioning with the travel management plan, even though I personally believe they should have, the reason why they didn't do it is because they have to go through a whole other set of NEPA to address that issue. How are we going to decommission this road? Are we going to throw seed down? Are we just going to like throw some branches on it, let nature do its thing? So they have to analyze all that and they have to put cost into it. So that's a big deal for them.
So that's a whole separate
process.
It's a whole
other issue. And every single national forest, it's not just the Gila, it's everybody, has to have their roads that they want to decommission identified by 2015. So that's going to be a big thing coming up too.
And then, Nathan, all of this works into the land use plan revision that's going to get kicked off the fourth quarter of 2014. So tell us more about this process.
Sure. The Gila land use plan revision is a process that's going to get started, as you said, in October of 2014. It's been waiting to be done for over 30 years. The governing document that now actually manages our beautiful Gila National Forest is from 1986. So they don't talk about climate change. They don't talk about any of those things. So that's going to be a whole big process. What they'll do first is they'll do something called an assessment phase, and that's where they will begin. An assessment phase is essentially where the agency looks internally and says, is there a need for change? That's sort of the verbatim quote. Is there a need for change to the plan?
And the land, and this is in land use. So tell us more what land use is.
It covers all of the natural resources of the Gila National Forest. So
it could be mining.
So mining, forestry,
logging,
grazing, fisheries, wildlife, wilderness, roadless.
Okay.
All of that
stuff. So it's everything.
It's everything. And it'll be like a gigantic, you know, thesaurus document. There'll probably be like three of them because they'll have to cover so much territory. There were new regulations that the Obama administration put out in 2012 that sort of kickstarted this process. They realized how old the regulations were from Reagan and that they wanted to change them. So they got them changed. They got some great stuff in there about using best available science, things like that. And so what it means for me, my job, I'm doing field work for the land use plan revision so that I can give this information to them during their assessment phase when they're looking internally to say, is there a need for change? Well, I'm going to give them data that says, yes, there is a need for change. And the need for change is we have lots of roadless areas in the Gila National Forest. There's close to 1 million acres of roadless land in the Gila. So that's outside of the 750,000 acres that we have with the wilderness areas already. And so we've got to look at roads. We've got to look at what roads could be decommissioned, which roads need to be left open for access or public use, and then all that's fine. So that's going to take a lot of time. And after they go through the assessment phase, then they'll start to do something called scoping, which is where NEPA begins, essentially. It's like pre-NEPA, where they sort of announce to the community, hey, we're doing this, we're holding these meetings, give us information, do you have anything you want to contribute to this? And after scoping, then they'll go through the draft, and it'll be a very similar process like with travel management, with alternatives and public and comment. And then they'll go through all that again, and then, you know, issue their final.
How long is that going to take?
You know, if travel management's taken eight, I want to be honest, but I also want to be hopeful. So maybe 10 years.
Really?
Maybe. It could be 10 years.
Okay. Wow. Unbelievable. So that's a pretty big process, and it's going to basically integrate then all the travel management planning that's been done is going to get integrated into this bigger land use plan.
Correct.
And then what happens? Implementation, that guides implementation for the next, 20, 30 years?
Well,
or just like the previous one?
Everybody that I've been talking to at the federal level, both at the BLM and the Forest Service, they're saying that they're going to have to do these things probably every 5 years from now, because they're supposed to do them every 10 to 20 years, but now we're seeing it's taking them 30 years to get these things done. I don't see how realistically they can get them done every 5 years, but, you know, that's what the internal target is. That's what they say. What they'll probably do is they won't go through such an extensive revision. They'll get the main document done, and then 5 years later, maybe do like a supplement or something like that to help tweak things that aren't working out in the field.
Are there some big hitter things that people should be paying attention to in this process? Like anything in particular that you all have identified that you think are going to be controversial or significant changes that people should be paying close attention to?
I think the wilderness issue is something that's really significant because, again, having close to 1 million acres of roadless areas in the Gila National Forest, if not more, we could see expansion of wilderness in the Gila, the Aldo Leopold, and even the creation of new wilderness areas up in the northern part of the National Forest, where, by the way, all the wolves are hanging out.
Right.
So it makes sense. That's the one thing I'll be focusing on. There are certainly other things that other groups and people will be focusing on, but I think collectively we should all be looking to work on it together moving forward.
All right. Well, we'll be right back after this short break and continue our discussion with Nathan Newcomer and Donna Stevens about the big conservation issues coming up in 2014. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, and my guests today are my Earth Matters co-producers, Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. And we're going to start talking about a huge issue for 2014, the Arizona Water Settlements Act and a potential Gila River diversion. And just as a little background, the Arizona Water Settlements Act was passed in 2004 to settle Native American water rights issues in Arizona. The act also gives New Mexico the right to use 14,000 acre feet per year of water from the Gila and San Francisco rivers if New Mexico agrees to pay for and replace that water through the Central Arizona Project. And after nearly 10 years of planning, the deadline to notify the Secretary of the Interior whether or not New Mexico will divert Gila River water is only a year away. And Donna, maybe you can fill us all in on where we are in the AWSA planning process.
Yeah, so like you said, this has been going on for 10 years. So there's been endless rounds of meetings, stakeholder meetings, public meetings, things kind of getting reorganized, and depending on who was the governor at the time. And right now, the Interstate Stream Commission, or ISC, has contracted with all kinds of consulting firms to do studies on feasibility. So they're studying things like watershed restoration, municipal conservation, agricultural conservation, a regional water system that would supply water to Silver City and the mining district, and they're also looking at diversions. So in all, there's 15 of these AWSA proposals, and these consultants are doing feasibility and cost studies on all of these proposals right now. And in the legislative session, they are supposed to report to the New Mexico legislature on what these proposals are, what they entail, to whatever level of detail they have, which we think probably won't be too great. And then there'll be time for the public to review and comment on these proposals.
So that's coming up in January. We're unclear, really, kind of what, how much information we're going to have in the Gila Conservation Coalition, of which GRIP and UGWA are a member, partners, and in GCC. GCC's been really pushing the Bureau of Reclamation and the Interstate Stream Commission to make public as soon as possible the results of some of these analyses, because what we're afraid of is that we won't see anything until the ISC presents it to the legislature in January, and we really want to be able to see these preliminary analyses and be able to comment on them before they get presented to the legislature. And then, you know, we've got a bunch of decision points, right, Donna, in 2014. And you know, this is the year. This is when it's going to matter that people are paying attention, attending meetings, providing their voice to the process. And Donna, what are we looking at for 2014?
Well, all the draft analyses have to be finished. The Interstate Stream Commission, Bureau of Reclamation, all of those draft reports are due in July, and then there'll be some public comment, and then all the reports need to be finalized by July. And then the decision points for the Interstate Stream Commission are, in August, they will make a preliminary decision on whether to divert or not divert the Gila River. And then in November, they'll release their final decision. And then by the end of the year, in December of 2014, the Interstate Stream Commission has to send a letter to the Secretary of the Interior stating whether they plan to divert Gila River water or not plan, or do some kind of a combination of diversion and non-diversion alternatives.
Right, and stakeholder meetings are being held every quarter. So we have the next stakeholder meeting coming up January 13th, and we'll see what we end up seeing, or what's available, and what the ISC and the Bureau of Reclamation decide to make public. So then the next quarterly meeting, April, another one in June, to probably coincide with the draft reports that will be made available. And we hope that people will be attending these meetings and also make public comment. One way for people to stay in touch is to join the Gila Conservation Coalition email list, which you can do at the Gila Conservation Coalition website at gilaconservation.org. Also join our Facebook page. You can stay on top of things there in real time if you're a Facebook user. And like Donna said, come August, there'll be an ISC meeting, and we're going to want to get people out for that ISC meeting where the ISC will make a preliminary decision. So very important times for people who care about the Gila River and care about seeing the Gila remain a free-flowing Gila River. And Donna, what else is going on this process in terms of non-diversion alternatives? You talked a bit about some of these non-diversion alternatives, like we've got the Grant County Regional Water Supply Project. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one? I mean, that's a huge one for us here in Silver City in the mining district.
Yeah, that's probably the project that would impact the largest number of people. So the regional water supply system, well, it would regionalize the water supply, and it would that would be water for people who are in Silver City and then in the mining district like Santa Clara, Bayard, Hurley. And this would affect about 26,000 people. So that's a lot of people being impacted by this kind of a regional water system. And there's also other non-diversion alternatives that are being looked at right now. One of these is municipal conservation. So even the Interstate Stream Commission says that the best thing to do is to conserve water. And so the municipal conservation system would do things like detect leaks. It could help people install appliances that use less water, low-flow toilets, that sort of thing. And also then there's agricultural conservation, things like having farmers install drip systems and other systems that use far less water than flood irrigation does. And there's also some watershed restoration projects that are being studied right now by the Interstate Stream Commission's consultants. And all of these are projects that would help us to reduce our water use so that we wouldn't need to have a diversion on the Gila River.
Right. And I think, if you look at all of the non-diversion alternatives that were proposed by stakeholders in southwestern New Mexico, and if you added up all of the water saved or generated by those projects, it's upwards of 22,000 acre feet per year at only a cost of about $82 million, which is significantly less than the cost of a diversion project. Donna, what are we talking about with a diversion project in comparison in terms of, what are the elements of the diversion project? And, we've heard costs of $300 million or more to construct it. So what are some of the proposals on the table for diversion right now?
Yeah, well, like you said, the non-diversion projects, we could actually implement all of those with the funding that's available right now, as opposed to a diversion project. And we've seen numbers anywhere from $190 million all the way up to $325 million. And the Arizona Water Settlements Act doesn't allocate that much money. And so if we build a new so-called New Mexico unit or diversion, the state could get up to about $128 million, which is nowhere near enough to build a diversion. And as we know, these diversion projects are notorious for going way over budget.
That's right. And as well, we're talking about a diversion location somewhere above the gauge station in the Cliff Gila Valley above Mogollon Creek, somewhere between the gauge and Turkey Creek. So a de facto wilderness area. And then the Bureau of Reclamation has some designs that we've seen at our stakeholder meetings of diversion with two canals running down both sides of the Cliff Gila Valley, both sides of the Gila River. These canals would be about the footprint 60 feet in cross section. So imagine, access road, concrete canals down both sides of the river, which right now you've got Mogollon Box Campground, where mm-hmm. people go and enjoy the Gila River at the campground, and imagine a big canal running through the campground. I mean, I don't know what would happen to the campground. I don't think it would have to go through the campground. You wouldn't have that area anymore. So this beautiful one of the last intact riparian bosques, cottonwood, sycamore, willow bosques in the southwest, home to 300 species of bird, you'd have this industrialized zone basically running through the valley. So we're talking significant impact to not only the river, but the riparian corridor, with impacts to hunters and sportsmen, fishermen, folks who are recreating along the river. So significant impacts, and we'll get a handle on those impacts in more detail when we see some of these analyses. But we know just by some of the designs that we've seen so far that this diversion project could be pretty significant. And Donna, again, tell us how people can stay informed about this issue. I mean, we've got three partners in the Gila Conservation Coalition: GRIP, Gila Resources Information Project, Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and the Center for Biological Diversity. What's UGWA's website for people to stay up to date?
It's UGWA.org, UGWA.org. And people can, if people want to get involved, they can certainly come to the quarterly meetings held by the Interstate Stream Commission. And as we said, the next one is happening January 13th, right here in Silver City on the campus at Western New Mexico University.
And that's at 6 o'clock, right?
It's at 6 o'clock,
in
right.
In the third floor seminar room in the right. Student Union.
And they can also go to the Gila Conservation website, gilaconservation.org. And Gila Conservation Coalition is holding meetings to inform the public of what's going on. Because let's face it, some of the information that you get at the Interstate Stream Commission meetings always has a little bit of a spin to it. So going to the Gila Conservation Coalition meetings is a really good way to stay engaged.
Well, thanks, Donna. We'll be right back after this short break and continue our discussion with Nathan Newcomer and Donna Stevens about the biggest conservation issues of 2014. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, and my guests today are my Earth Matters co-producers Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. And we have lots of reason to celebrate in 2014. The Wilderness Act is turning 50, and the Gila Wilderness is turning 90. And also, the Gila River Festival will be putting on its 10th annual festival. So, Nathan, tell us more about the Wilderness Act and the celebrations that will be going on here in New Mexico.
It's really exciting stuff. The big thing that's happening is, of course, the national conference. So Albuquerque beat out a whole bunch of other cities across the country to host the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act conference. So there's going to be a national conference in Albuquerque that the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is one of the main sponsors of. There's a lot of other conservation groups involved from all over the West and the East. So we're hearing actually that former President Jimmy Carter may actually attend.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. Senator Martin Heinrich is confirmed. Senator Tom Udall is confirmed. A lot of Terry Tempest Williams will be there speaking, which is pretty great. So we're expecting probably around 1,500 to 2,000 people to attend this thing. And it will happen October 15th through the 19th, so right after Balloon Fiesta.
Great.
So there'll be lots of speakers and lots of events. There'll be a little music festival that's associated with it, hikes, of course, outings, things of that nature.
And what is the Wilderness Act? Just tell us briefly, what are we celebrating?
We are celebrating one of the greatest pieces of legislation ever written. It's actually one of the most poetic pieces of legislation that was ever written by Howard Zonizer. It took him about 30 years to actually get that thing done. I'm actually exaggerating a little bit, but it did take him a while. The Wilderness Act essentially created the National Wilderness Preservation System, which is what we have today. And every time a new wilderness bill is introduced, it gets added to that system. And so wilderness areas are places where, as you and I know, people cannot go in and start trashing the place. You can't log, you can't mine, you can't drill for oil and gas, can't drive vehicles in there. It's all non-motorized forms of recreation, whether it be horseback riding, hunting, hiking, backpacking, birdwatching, fishing, kayaking, floating down the river, whatever. I mean, anything that where you leave no trace, essentially. A wilderness area is an area that is untrammeled by man. And a trammel is something that confines a horse's two front hooves when you're in the backcountry so it doesn't run away, and it can only just jump up and down through a field. So to be untrammeled is to be unconfined, to be free. And so essentially, in my mind, wilderness is freedom. It represents the quintessential form of freedom, where you can go into the Gila Wilderness and do your thing and not be bothered and love the land. It's a beautiful feeling.
And we here in the Gila region have the nation's first wilderness area. So designated in 1924, before we had the Wilderness Act. Can you tell us a bit about the Gila Wilderness and the 90th anniversary?
Sure. Everyone knows Aldo Leopold, or most everyone, at least in Silver City. He has a school named after him, thankfully. In 1922, he actually proposed that the Gila watershed, which is now the Gila Wilderness, be set aside as a primitive area. And it took it 2 years for it to go through to D.C. for it to actually be administratively designated as a primitive area. It was called the Gila Wilderness and Primitive Area. But then over the years, due to two world wars and a hunger for timber, essentially, the Gila Wilderness Primitive Area got chopped down, got shortened, got made smaller in different places, and the North Star Road came in. We all know that story. And so now it's been split up into two different wilderness areas, the Aldo Leopold and the Gila. And the Gila is at 480,000 acres. So the 90th anniversary celebration is really great that that's coming up too, to help honor a gentleman who had the vision and foresight to set aside large areas where people could not go in there and have their way with it. So what we're doing to celebrate that is we are partnering with the Silver City Museum here locally. They're going to do an exhibition beginning in May. It'll be a soft opening in May. Then they'll do like an official hoorah thing in June to honor Aldo Leopold. And there'll be this 6-month-long exhibition up at the Silver City Museum about wilderness. They'll have another one in September to coordinate with the Gila River Festival, which is really exciting. So hopefully we can work together on that moving forward next year on getting some great speakers here and great panels and workshops. So I'm really, really excited for the celebrations that are coming up next year, because there's going to be a lot of activity and a lot of opportunity to do some great stuff.
So June, is it 5th or 6th?
3rd.
June 3rd is the officially the 90th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness.
Correct.
All right, so mark your calendars.
And September 3rd is the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act.
Okay, September 3rd.
June 3rd.
And then Donna, September 18th through the 21st, is the 10th annual Gila River Festival that's going to really work in with these wilderness-related anniversaries. Can you tell us more?
Sure. It's kind of amazing that it really is the 10th annual Gila River Festival.
Sure is.
We've done this 10 times now. And so we will be talking about the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act and the other important anniversary of the Gila Wilderness turning 90 years old. And some of the things that we have planned so far is we'll have a couple of really great speakers. We have Dave Foreman, who was here once before and really packed the room. And he'll be talking about wilderness, the importance of wilderness, the Gila Wilderness in particular.
And the theme for the Gila River Festival is what?
It's celebrating America's first wilderness river.
Okay. So the Gila River running through the Gila Wilderness.
Yep, exactly. So in addition to Dave Foreman, we also have a speaker named Wade Davis. And he will be talking about watershed issues. So he has written a book called River Notes, and that's about the Colorado River Basin, which, of course, the Gila is part of. And he also did a film about his trip down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. And we hope to be showing that film. We still have to work out all the details on that. And then there's going to be some artwork, too. So there's a group called Signal Fire. And this is a group of artists who go to a different wilderness area every year and do their art. And they will be here in April. Mm-hmm. Of this year. And they'll go into the Gila Wilderness and create all of their artwork. And then that will be on exhibit here during the Gila River Festival. And then we also have Michael Berman, who's a pretty well-known photographer, a Guggenheim fellow, and he will have his show of Gila River photos, Gila photos, at the Silver City Museum, and that'll be during the Gila River Festival as well. And of course, we'll do our usual field trips, guided field trips on all kinds of topics like herpetology, native plants, geology, rock art, all those kinds of things, archaeology. And if there's enough water in the river, we'll also do the kayak trips again. Those are always popular.
That's right, right. So, let's talk more about wilderness and really what this means, and especially what does it mean to be the nation's first wilderness area? I mean, yeah. Nathan, you spoke eloquently about wilderness before, but you're out there. That's
it's
your job.
It's my
is
job.
To be
yeah.
out there inventorying potential right. new wilderness areas and
monitoring existing wilderness areas for things like cow trespass. We don't want to see there's certain areas of the Gila where cows are not supposed to be in there. And so one really cool thing that I just got set up is a neighbor of mine, he and I are going to work together to install motion sensor infrared wildlife cameras throughout the Gila wilderness and throughout areas that could potentially be added to the Gila wilderness. And he sent me some photos of some mountain lions that were just like, holy cow, I really can't wait to get these cameras up in some of these spots because I know that there's going to be some wildlife there. One day I was doing some inventory up on Tadpole Ridge and came up to this lake and there was these gigantic bear paws just squished into the mud. They're super fresh, maybe an hour before, if that. So that was pretty wild. It's a really great feeling when you get to work on something like wilderness because it's something way bigger than yourself. It's mm-hmm. just, you know, I don't care if anybody remembers my name after I'm dead, but as long as we get more wilderness protected, hoorah, let's go do it. And that's just the way I feel about it. So to be able to work on it, it's just a really humbling, honoring experience, knowing that you get to do that, and it may take a lifetime, actually, to get a new wilderness area created. So it's really great. It's wilderness is something that a lot of people, I think, don't necessarily really understand what it is. They look at the national forest, and they kind of think, well, isn't it all just national forests? And it's like, well, it is, but there's also this thing called wilderness and what wilderness is and how you sort of relate to it. I think people are sort of losing touch with it.
That's right.
Especially like the newer generation that's coming up, maybe not here in Silver City, but elsewhere like in Albuquerque, kids are plugged in their phones all the time or plugged into the computer, the internet all the time playing video games. It's like, get out, get dirty, go run around in the fields. And I mean, that's what I did when I was growing up. And that sort of wilderness is like that last vestige of, you know, hope and freedom, like I said earlier, that really just pulls on my heartstrings and makes me feel great.
Right.
So looking at the 90th and looking at the 50th next year, it's just such a great thing to know that we've made it this far with wilderness, and hopefully we can make it, you know, in 10 years from now, we're going to be at the 100th anniversary of the Gila, and that's going to be a really special time.
Right, and we have Dave Foreman, who mm-hmm. is really, who will be speaking at the Gila River Festival. I'm sure he's probably on the agenda for the Wilderness 50th anniversary, but
yeah.
he's really a wilderness hero, got his start here in the Gila region.
Yes.
And then he's made a career of, through his Rewilding Institute, of looking at wilderness as a way to provide habitat, huge tracts of habitat
right.
for...
Spine of the continent.
Right. That's right, for species. And of course, the Gila River is so, so, so important to as a wildlife corridor.
Mm-hmm.
So can you guys comment a little bit more on wilderness for wildlife?
Yeah, I mean, it's super important for wildlife. I mean, when you look at the health of a wilderness area, you look for large predators. If you find large predators that are thriving and looking healthy and good, then you know everybody else is doing pretty darn well. So signs of black bear, signs of mountain lion, signs of wolves, those are really good things. And those are sort of the things that I look at. When I do my field work, when I'm setting up these wildlife cameras, I'm looking for cats, man. I'm looking for bears because if they're there, then we know the deer are doing great. We know the elk are doing great. And we know that the overall health of the ecosystem is doing great. So wilderness and wildlife are one and the same. I mean, without the wildlife, it's just scenery, right? So, I mean, scenery is great, but we want to have habitat. And so habitat is really important. And wilderness is sort of the gold standard, if you will, for habitat and species protection.
That's right. Well, Nathan and Donna, it really has been a pleasure speaking with you today. And thank you all for listening to this week's program. There will be a lot going on in 2014 that we didn't discuss on today's program, such as GRIP's appeal of the copper mining water quality rule, the National Monument designation for the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks, and the upcoming legislative session. So in 2014, Earth Matters will bring you interviews with activists, scientists, policymakers, and elected officials on these issues and more. So we hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Membrus Community Radio.